So this was the title I got from Lars. I think, given what we heard earlier, a better title of this is a quote from Bob himself. So the name of the game here is going to be trying to derive whatever one can from spectra. As we all know, supernovae spectra have the nice feature that they change very rapidly with time. So they allow you to sort of scan through the properties of the supernovae. This is not just type 1As, but I mean, this is the application that we're going to be going through today. Earlier on, one can compare them to spectra of hot stars with hot photospheres and absorption lines that look like B-Cygni profiles superposed onto it, which reveal something about the velocity structure of the outer ejector. Later on, and this is something we've probably not heard about yet, they totally transform. The physics becomes that of a nebula, where the gas is heated by collisions, basically, and cools via forbidden lines and allow transitions as well. And that's a very powerful epoch to look at. You get much fewer supernovae, but you can do a lot of interesting work because you actually see through the gas at that point. So what can one get from observations? Well, we go back to this because this was key, in a sense, to some of the work that will follow. And this, of course, goes back to Mark. It's been reviewed many times, but it's still the seminal thing, that brightness and Leica shape are related. Also very important, I find, is the fact that bolometric Leicas, and this is Gertrud and Brunner's work, show a similar relation, which means there is some physical quantity that actually causes this. And again, I have to quote Bob on this, because whenever you write a paper and you don't cite this, you get, exactly, or... So this was probably, a fairly direct demonstration that cobalt is there. It's only there temporarily because it declines. It decays into iron 56, but the cobalt is made from nickel 56, which is how supernova light comes about. And Bob will make a point of telling you every time you write a paper, if you forget to quote that. You never learn the first time, do you? I don't. So, spectra of 1As, well, what is a really normal 1A? Somewhere in the middle of that bunch is what you would call a normal 1A. They all more or less show the silicon line, which is going to be interesting to look at, except for maybe the 91Ts, the brighter ones early on, because the temperatures are too high for silicon too. Elsewhere, the spectra evolve. They change quite a bit, mostly depending on temperature, like the titanium structure and so on, but also sometimes reflecting abundance changes, which one can try and learn more about. Just looking at this silicon line, Stefano Benetti a couple of years ago came up with an interesting subdivision of 1As into what he calls velocity class, where he measures the evolution of the line velocity over time and derives that there are three groups that you can basically divide all the 1As into. The faint 91BG types are outside of everything else, but then all the normal and bright looking 1As divide into rapid evolution, so they go from very fast to slower, or slow evolution of line velocity. And they actually separate out quite nicely in these V-dot delta M15 plots, which may be interesting. Whether that is correlated with the detection of high velocity in lines such as calcium or silicon remains to be seen, because these are seen more or less everywhere. Whenever you have a chance to observe type 1A supernovae very early on, which is one of the keys, actually, I think, to deriving more information, as well as indirect things such as, whatever. So what happens here? Well, we can measure velocities in these features of up to 20,000-25,000 kilometers per second. In the nebula phase, we go down to velocities that are of the order of 1,000 kilometers per second. So if we actually follow these spectra as they evolve, we can more or less monitor the entire supernova ejector over a space of about a year. So one just has to be persistent and get enough telescope time, and one can try and play that sort of game. So high velocity features maybe tell us something about the outer layers of the explosion, or whatever surrounds the star that is exploding. And this is work that Masaomi Tanaka, who just got his PhD at the University of Tokyo, did a couple of years back with us. And that is trying to simulate spectra of 1As very early on, doing things in 3D on the top of the ejector. And to get these high velocity things, you have to sort of invoke the presence of blobs of material, and that can be of various origin. And you can play with the distribution size and whatever of lobs. But what you're trying to do is fit in a situation where you have more or less for every supernova you find something at high velocity. So you want a distribution of these things that isn't one-sided to the point that you will see significant differences between one supernova and the other. And one inference from that is that if you want blobs, they have to be few and fairly large. If you want a torus, that also works if it's a fairly thick torus. You don't want too many blobs, you don't want too few. It's sort of in there is sort of the right solution, or a thick torus is the right solution. Where does that come about? It may be from the explosion, but then you need to invoke very strange abundances where calcium dominates. It's actually more likely that this stuff is entrained from the high-velocity material that is ejected. And it may even contain some hydrogen, which actually helps forming some of these lines. So there may be indirect evidence there for some circumstellar material at the 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 solar mass level, mass loss rate. And once you do that, as Armin showed, you can basically fit whatever you want. I mean, obviously, you've got the freedom of playing with that. So the outside sort of looks like Swiss cheese, if you wish. And in a sense, polarization should confirm that if we had early enough data. Later on, observations simply show a very similar pattern as to the early time data. The spectra are very similar now throughout the luminosities. What changes is the width of the lines. You go from very broad lines at the brightest end, like 91T, to very narrow lines at the faintest end, like 91BG. But the lines remain more or less the same. And by more or less, I mean the 91BG has more iron 3 than the others. The velocity, then, that you measure indicates roughly where the nickel is located, because the nickel declines eventually into iron. So by measuring a higher velocity, you're simply looking at a bigger iron ball, which is consistent with the fact that these supernovae with low decline rate are brighter than those with a high decline rate, and so therefore contain more nickel. You can even try and plot this. This is a very old plot. And there is some trend, again, between full width half maximum of these lines and decline rate. So you want to connect this late phase information to the early phase information. And the way to do that that we thought would be useful is to do what we call abundance tomography, which is we follow a spectrum, a supernova, through a series of spectra, and we try to model epoch after epoch, seeing how the abundances that are present near the photosphere that make the spectrum change with depth. And as I said, as you observe later in time, you observe deeper in the supernova ejector. And you can do that for, it's not easy work, it takes time, so people get bored. You can do this with supernovae of different luminosity, and you get significantly different results. The same is reflected in the nebula spectra, which of course show broader lines if the supernova is bright and narrow lines if the supernova is less bright. You put all that together in an abundance versus mass or velocity diagram, and you compare this with a classic explosion model such as W7, which has been sort of the workhorse for most of this work and for most people looking at supernova observations. And you will see that the distribution of elements is actually quite similar. So the iron, the nickel is sort of at intermediate to low velocities. There is some stable material, mostly iron group at lowest velocities. Intermediate mass elements such as silicon and sulfur are present at higher velocities. But modeling indicates that the mixing is a bit more thorough than the model itself had predicted. These are both 1D approaches, so in a sense, any 3D effects are taken out or neglected, if you prefer. The presence of unburnt material remains a bit of a mystery. There's very rarely any carbon detected. There is some oxygen, usually at higher velocities, but never very much, indicating already here that a lot of the white dwarf has been burnt. And the assumption here is they're all Chandrasekhar mass. You now go to the somewhat less bright supernova, and you compare that to the brighter one. The red line is like the black line here. The nickel does not extend as far out in the dimmer type 1A, which also comes together with the fact that the emission line at later times was narrower than in this particular supernova here. Other than that, you've got the same overall structure, stable intermediate mass elements, silicon sulfur, a bit more unburnt material up there, but not significantly. You can try and close this loop by computing Likert's using these abundance distributions and so some simple approximation to the opacities that causes. And you'll find that mostly by the mixing out that you get in the earlier spectra, you actually get an earlier rise, which helps fixing. This is just Bohr-metric, so it's just a simple approach. But just the mixing helps fitting light curves. So you now want to go to the nebula spectra to look at the innermost part of the supernova ejecta. By modeling these spectra, you get mostly the distribution of Nicol 56, some other elements which emit, and you can actually play with a Nicol 56 versus the stable iron, which is something one can also do by looking at line ratios and an emitted flux. So an improved version of this velocity decline rate plot includes now 20 odd objects, and more or less reflects the earlier version of the plot. If you do this in terms of Nicol 56 mass, you also get a nice tight relation with a few deviant objects. And the color coding here is the same as what Stefano was using. So this is something that's got nothing to do with the late phase spectra. These are early time measurements of the velocity evolution that was used to color code the supernovae. So the blue supernova, which is what Stefano calls high velocity gradient, so they change velocity very rapidly, seem to be the ones that fall mostly out of that plot for reasons that we do not understand. But of course, 91 BGs and partners are down there. I mentioned the stable material. That's important to keep the ionization rate at the level that your spectra show between ion 2 and ion 3. But if you actually compare the 56 nickel to the stable iron, there seems to be not much of a relation, except the 91 BGs and partners are down here, and you know, the rest is sort of scattered. What gets interesting is if you try to do a delta M15 plot versus the entire abundance of ion group material, radioactive or stable, and that gives you again a nice correlation. It's actually a tighter correlation than simply using Nicol 56, which is interesting because it probably tells you that the light curve is driven by mostly 56 nickel, but indirectly, the role that iron and the nickel itself have on the opacity, which is what actually causes the light curve. And you can do this in velocity or mass, and that shows, as expected, that the brighter supernovae here with a smaller value of the decline rate burn more into nickel 56. Now you connect to the velocity measurements that I was describing earlier from Stefano, and you find that the lowest velocities of the silicon match very nicely the outer velocities of the iron as derived from the nebula spectrum, which is very nice because it shows us an interface between partial and complete burning. Not unexpected, but it's nice to show that. But what is most surprising is that at the high velocity end, except for the blue supernova, so the high velocity gradient, most of the other ones seem to bottom out at velocities that are, or start from, velocities that are about constant, regardless of the luminosity of the supernova. And if you transform that into a mass, that indicates that you've been burning about a constant fraction. And this is a lower limit, of course, because one needs earlier data to see how much further this can go. But you've been burning most of the white dwarf into at least silicon. And that's important because you get kinetic energy from doing that. So if you put it together, you get this by now old Zorro diagram where you start with the stable material which sits at the center, something that Stan's models have also been predicting. And we see this from the nebula spectra basically. And you have a constant sort of 0.1 to 0.2 solar masses of material in stable iron. The nickel 56 of course follows the distribution that we've been talking about. Once you put the nickel and the stable material iron group together, you get this relation, which is tighter, that's the dispersion, than just the nickel 56. And then the silicon basically shows how far you've been burning. And so what you get from this is, well, that just puts it all together. What can you say based on this finding? Well, you've been burning more or less a constant fraction of the star. It may even be most of it or all of it, but the important thing is because you make almost as much kinetic energy from burning into silicon as you do from burning into nickel, the kinetic energy of the explosion is about constant. So if you start from a constant chandrasekhar mass white dwarf, you're going to get supernovae that look similar because they have similar kinetic energy. The temperature and the luminosity will depend, however, on the nickel 56, and so they will give you different spectra, different light curves, as far as brightness is concerned. Now, to get a distribution like that, most likely implies that the best scenario is a delayed detonation, where you start burning, as we heard yesterday from Fritz and others, you start burning subsonically, and then you make a transition to supersonic, where you burn whatever is left. And there is this sort of counterintuitive argument where the most effective deflagrations give you the dimmest supernovae, but we've heard all about that yesterday. And one can try to recover the light curve luminosity relation by basically plugging in a couple of formulas from stolen from various people. And you can do a synthetic light curve width simply based on the abundances and the light curve and the kinetic energy you get from the abundances themselves, and compare that to the observed volumetric light curve width from Gertrude's papers and newer data. And the two actually agree very, very nicely, which suggests we sort of know how things work, and this is all, again, 1D stuff. So is that the end of the story? Well, it is in a sense. I mean, this is probably as far as 1D treatments can go, but there are corners of parameter space where you may still want to do some exploring. In 91BG, which we've heard a lot about today and in previous days, is interesting because there's questions there. Fritz can't get models that are as faint as that. There's issues as to whether the mass can be Chandrasekhar. There's issues as to whether they come from the same sort of environment, because they've been found to be more often in older environments than the average 1A. And so can there be differences at that end of the diagram? This is work that a student of mine has been doing, which was recently posted, I think. He's been rescaling, essentially, W7, adopting different energies and different masses. So he's allowed himself the freedom of doing what we call super tomography. So it's not just taking one model, but taking various sort of incarnations of W7 for different energies and masses. And it was suggested early on that there is inconsistency between synthetic spectra for 91BG and the W7 model. You get lines that are too broad, and in a paper years ago, I suggested that a lower mass than Chandrasekhar will give you better models. So we've been looking at that again, but now we've been looking at lower energies. And as soon as you go to lower energies, and essentially to a lower E over M ratio, your silicon line, which is in this blow up here, becomes narrow, which is what you want. And the same happens for the oxygen line. And the key is not so much reduce the mass, it seems, but to go down in energy. So you can go simply down in energy for a Chandrasekhar model. You can even go to a super Chandrasekhar model and keep the W7 energy, which means you get less efficient burning and less energy per unit mass, and you get an improvement to the spectra. So you do the fits to the entire spectral sequence here of 05BL, which is a clone of 91BG, and then you try and assess the goodness of these models based on a number of criteria, one being just a spectral fitting. So are the velocities of your lines in agreement with the data? And that's a black line sort of as a locus of best fit. You can do an energetic derivation. You sort of derive your abundances and work out what energy that would have implied based on the mass of your progenitor, which has different binding energy, different using different masses, of course. And that's your green line here, which is sort of curved, and they kind of join there. And the thickness of the shading or the darkness of the green are sort of where the better models lie. So somewhere in this area, which is certainly lower energies than W7, which is out here, but not necessarily different masses than Chandrasekhar, although maybe a somewhat lower mass could be preferred, although that may be within the noise. That seems to do best. What about the abundance distribution in 05BL or, I think, 91BG? It's actually quite different from what I've been showing you before. The nickel 56 never really reaches close to 100%. The intermediate mass elements, silicon here, go down to very low velocities and dominate the abundances at all times. The unburthed material also continues down to fairly low velocities. Okay. And we know, of course, that 91BGs are associated with all populations. We've even tried to see what 91BG would have looked like had it been observed very early on. It actually looks quite different from what we're familiar with. The titanium lines aren't developed as much as one would have thought, especially the earliest epoch here. And then, say, 10 days before maximum, for which we have no 91BG light spectrum, the silicon line is still very weak. So, if you see anything looking like that, it may be 91BG coming. Well, you'll know that within a few days, but that's what you may be seeing if you observe early enough. So the conclusions I'll leave you with, I think the inverse approach has power, and we actually need more data and early data, I think, to to see more. Thank you.
So in DGT models that we've been doing, and I think Fritz's has a similar feature, in 2D, not all of the stable iron group stuff ends up at the center like it does in W7, just because W7 is 1D. So it may end up there, but often it's not quite at the center. Does it have to be at the center all the time? That's the, like, how strong is the constraint
Let's
on
say
having
this
that?
Was the assumption. Where you put the stable ion, you get most cooling. So if you mix stable ion significantly with nickel 56, you get less iron 3 for the nebula phase. And so given the ratios of iron 3 to iron 2 that you normally get, it would be hard to have a lot of microscopic mixing of iron, of stable and radioactive material. One would have to see what other possibilities there are, but it is, you know, to get this nebula spectra out, to put it in the center is where you want it to be. So, yeah, so.
Just a remark, we did actually Chandrasekharov delay detonation where we really needed that the stable iron has to stay in the center, and also the nickel cannot be mixed out very far because otherwise we will have excited silicon too much.
Yeah.
This was one remark. The other remark, not necessarily for 91BG because we don't have late time spectra, but in normal type 1A, when we look very late in the spectra, in the infrared, where we have unblended lines, we always seem to see flat-topped profiles. This means velocity, excitation at the lowest velocity is mixing, and that's at least consistent that the center is filled with stable isotopes and very little nickel, because otherwise you would get those peak profiles. So the problem, that's really one of the problems, why don't we mix more than we actually see?
I have a follow-up to that, the issue of whether the neutron-rich NSC and the stable nickel mixes out or not. I have a poster out. One of the interesting things we've seen lately with the X-ray spectra of type 1A supernova remnants, and in particular the case of Tycho, is we're beginning to detect the lines from very minor elements like chromium and manganese. But there is no stable nickel line in the spectrum of the Tycho supernova remnant. And that is also telling you that you cannot mix that much nickel, stable nickel, out, because if you did, the reverse shot would have processed it and we would see it. In a normal type 1A supernova, there is a lot more stable nickel than chromium and manganese. So that fact is telling you that there cannot be that much mixing.
Well, when it comes to stable nickel, we can actually put an upper limit to that because it would have a line in these spectra 1 year on at about 7,000 angstroms. So there's only so much stable nickel we can put in, and that's not very much.
Yeah. Also, the stable ion problem. If those stable ones are produced in deflagration phase, and if the variation of the type 1A is caused by this strong deflagration, weak deflagration, and so on, then the stable, the amount of stable ion peak elements also should show some variation. So the question is, how much is the error bars in your
program? Well, I showed it earlier. There's a dispersion of, you know, less than a factor of 2. Okay. Around this mean value of, say, 0.15. So the range, it's between 0.1 and 0.2. And it doesn't follow luminosity or whatever it is.
Probably that would be an important constraint on the ignitions, yeah.
Yeah, a question about the nebular spectrum. Since Bob's pioneering work teaching us that the iron lines were permitted iron 2 and iron 3, we've all believed that. Dave Branch had an interesting paper recently arguing that he could fit that nebular spectrum with permitted lines. And I just wondered whether you or Bob had any...
These are mostly forbidden transitions, and I can give you the wavelengths. These low-lying, you know, transitions between levels of just a few EV from the ground state that are connected by forbidden lines.
So I think it went by too fast. I didn't understand the lowering the energy argument in the 91BG likes. So, I mean, you know, you get what you get to burning to different elements. So I presume you're just not doing as complete burning for these when you lower the energy. Is that what's going on?
What you do is you assume a model with a lower energy. Okay? You just assume that that is a density distribution that you get from injecting less energy. Then you go out and find how, you know, what are the relative abundances of various elements. You know how much burning into one particular element is going to give you, and you just try and find out whether there is consistency between what you get from the spectral fit and what you've been assuming to begin with.
Is that? Not, okay, well, maybe we'll talk about it offline. I'm not quite getting it.
Steph.
Yeah, Paolo, just a suggestion on the mixing. I think that we're running up against people thinking the term means different things. In one dimension, mixing can only be accomplished by stirring at the microscopic level. But in 2D and 3D, you can have fingers of
stable iron. You can certainly have pockets of material.
And they don't have any nickel in them, and the spectrum of those two things are different.
Yeah, this phase is an interesting phase because you have the positrons, but you still have gamma rays. And the gamma rays travel. And you can have gamma rays travel from nickel 56 into a pocket of iron 56 andexite. I mean, we can do that. It's just a matter of, you know, designing a model and trying. But there is a limit into, you know, that you run into where your gammas will excite the stable iron pocket if it's not too dense, right? So there will be a time when this may happen. So it's an interesting test one could do.
All right. Thank you very much, Paolo.
Yeah.